Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We have lift off with Odds from the Vaults. What we got this week, Gary?
Well, this week, Pete, it's Haig in the Boer War, because he was in a lot of wars, and he's there with just about everybody you've ever heard of.
It's amazing. If only I knew more about it.
Well, listen to the podcast and you may well know less.
Yeah, that's true. Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans about their experience of war. Join me on a journey through the pages of history. Welcome to Peter Hart's Military History.
Hello, hello, hello. We're here again. I'm Peter Hart, and I'm with the sexiest man in North London, described as such by many. What's your name, sexiest man in North London?
Gary Bain.
Gary Bain. Even the way he says it, it's mellifluous, listeners.
Yeah.
Mellifluous.
I should correct you, Pete. We're not actually together. A Zoom recording yet again, and the British government's just announced we're going into full lockdown. Deep joy.
Deep joy indeed. I'm enjoying it already.
Yeah.
So, what are we talking about today, Gary?
Well, first of all, Pete, I'd like to congratulate you, if I may, on your new book.
You mean the Gallipoli evacuation?
You nearly forgot, didn't you?
I didn't nearly forget. I would never forget. I am a professional historian. I always know what my books are called.
How did you get on with the batteries, professional historian, for your sound recording?
Well, I did have to change it because I'd let them run down. But the punters wouldn't have known that.
I do now.
I'm absolutely delighted that the book's out. It's finally out. There were one or two delays. Did you notice any delays?
To be fair, you know, COVID has impacted a number of industries and it did have an impact.
Yeah, it's apparently the Australian printing industry is in bits. Too much demand. I think it's probably the demand for printing the book. Do you reckon?
Demand for your book, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, it'll have thrown the whole industry out of kilter. Anyway, it's available. Where they can get it now. It'll be posted direct to your house if the bookshops are closed. And it's on livinghistorytv.com. So you can buy it there. And I hope you all do, because then I'll be able to carry on eating gruel and the occasional glass of cider, as opposed to the meaningless vista that lies before me if the book's not a success.
It's a very good book. I've got my copy, and, you know, large print is very helpful with my eye.
You have got wodgy eyes.
Yeah.
I nearly said something else.
Well, one of them.
Let's get on with the podcast. Enough of this disguised. It wasn't very well disguised. What are we talking about today, Gary?
Well, we're talking about young Haig again, and this time we're talking about when he was a major in the Second Boer War. Now, it's interesting that people perhaps might not know that there had been a previous Boer War, but there'd been a very short, I'd describe it as skirmish, between December of 1880 and March of 1881, which was the First Boer War.
Did we win that one?
We won that one, then I think we lost it again, and then we sort of won it. It had very obscure beginnings. It was apparently triggered around the seizure of some goods of a Boer who hadn't paid a tax bill, apparently. So I'm paying my tax tomorrow, just in case.
Yeah, you don't want to start a war.
No. But we're talking about the Second Boer War and Haig's part in it.
Now, so where are we with Haig? We urge people to listen to our first one, which is sort of Douglas Haig and the battle and the Sudan campaign. That had given Douglas Haig his first battle experience, hadn't it? And it was quite an experience. Tens of thousands of Mahdi warriors charged towards him. He'd seen action for the first time, and he'd done well. But it's going to be very different in the Boer War. It's a different set of challenges, isn't it? Very different. And we're going to look at how he responds, aren't we?
Yeah, so where was Haig at this time, just prior to the Boer War? So the Boer War starts in 1899, doesn't it? So what was Haig doing?
Well, he'd gone back home in 1898. I think he starts back home in September 1898 after the Sudan campaign. And he comes back to the 7th Hussars. Fine body of men, you would normally say. Lovely uniform. Lovely, lovely. They were all from Birmingham, 7th Hussars.
Where were they based?
Norwich. Now, the thing about Norwich is it's got some things in common with Khartoum, because it's sort of there's a river that sort of bends round it, and it's a sort of featureless desert.
I apologise unreservedly to the residents of Norwich.
Well, he didn't seem to like it much. He was back in regimental duties. What was one of the highlights of his regimental duties that crops up in his diary? Come on, Gary. What was the highlight of his activities?
He was given control of the regimental canteen and ordering the fish from the market.
Oh, that's a big job, Gary. It's a big job. Well, he was a big man. So that's it. And he's training his squadron. He was a great believer that officers should always train up their squadrons. And of course, there's sport, there's polo, there's all that sort of things. But it's a bit repetitive, isn't it? He'd done this before, hadn't he?
Yeah, and he'd also been given promises of a staff posting, and that seems to have disappeared. So he was probably not having the greatest time of his career, to be fair.
No, a young officer, and although he's still a young officer, but his career isn't exactly motoring along, is it? It's doing well, but he must have been wondering what was happening. But in April, he gets his big step up. And this is when he goes off to act as brigade major to the cavalry brigade under the command of Brigadier General John French, who is featured throughout Haig's career.
Yeah, he first met him in India, hadn't he?
Yeah. But there's a terrible scandal. Now, this scandal, it's one of those things that it's completely understandable what Haig did. But it could have, and I would say probably should have, ended both of their careers. You know more about this than me. What had happened? Just fill it in for us. What did Haig do, and why was it wrong?
Well, Brigadier General French was not good with money. Amongst other things, he had a very different lifestyle to Haig's. And he'd made some rather poor investments in some South African mining shares.
So he was a greedy bugger trying to make a massive profit.
Well, he was speculating, I think it's fair to say. Now, there is no exaggeration here. He was on the brink of bankruptcy as a result, and his creditors were pushing him very, very, very hard. He approached Haig. It wasn't an offer. He actually asked Haig for a loan. Now, Haig's legal advisor told Haig that he couldn't do what he wanted to do. He just wanted to guarantee the amount to the creditors. And it was his lawyer that told him he would have to make a loan. And Haig eventually gave way. And this is a quote that talks about the most pressing amount. There was £800 that was needed practically within 24 hours to stave off the bankruptcy. It was that close.
The brink.
And the total amount ended up being around £2,000, which in today's money is around about £100,000. This is a serious amount of money. And Haig says in a communication with his lawyer, "I've wired that I'll produce the £800. It would be a terrible thing if French was made a bankrupt. Such a loss to the army as well as to me personally. For, of course, we can do a lot here together towards improving things. And so I think he genuinely felt that. That's genuine sentiment, I think.
But it's still wrong, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, £2,000 at the time was a fortune. Bear in mind that whilst Haig had a reasonable income from the estate from his father, who we've mentioned passed away previously and was a successful businessman, that was split amongst his siblings. So he was never well off. And indeed, after the Great War, he couldn't afford to purchase Bermondsey. That was purchased for him by public subscription. So this was an enormous amount of money.
Now, so he did it, and people often pick, people who hate Haig will pick on it. Funny enough, I think it is wrong. If you did it in the modern army, your feet wouldn't touch the ground, I suspect.
Well, the problem is that you know, John French could influence his career, directly influence his career. And that's the problem. There is also some debate about how and when it was paid back. It seemingly interest was charged, so it was a proper legal agreement around the loan.
But not a public one,
and I don't believe that it was paid back any time quickly. And I've read dates that are as late as 1909, for example.
Blimey. We'll have to move on. In September 1899, Sir John French, well, not Sir, I don't think he was Sir then, he was made Major General. John French. And he was posted as commander of the cavalry in Natal. And Haig was going to be his deputy assistant adjutant general. Or his dog.
Dog. That's like a chief of staff, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That is exactly what it's like, Gary. And they had to go, pell-mell. They went. There was no doubt. They caught the SS Norman and they went off on the 23rd of September. Now, they were heading for the Boer War. And we've got strong opinions about the Boer War, haven't we, Gary? It's quite interesting. We're agin it, aren't we? We're agin it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it's naked imperialism. There wasn't a great deal of interest in the Transvaal, and indeed the railways sort of just hugged the coast. They didn't go very far up into the Transvaal until the discovery of gold.
Ooh. Gold, there be gold in them, the hills.
Yeah, so I think it was, the Brits had various degrees of wanting to be involved in South Africa or not wanting to be involved. They wanted a single state, they wanted control of individual states, as did the Germans. You know, the Germans were active there as well. So I think we both think it's naked imperialism.
Yeah, it is. Now, the trouble was, we'd rather underestimated the Boers, had we? From top to bottom, the Boer armies of the Transvaal and Orange Free States, they totaled 54,000 men. Now, how many did we have in theatre at that time, Gary? You've looked this up, haven't you?
Oh, we had more than enough to cope with that. We had 15,000.
Ah, so just the 39,000 less. But presumably the Boers are a bit like fuzzy wuzzies, as the rather racist expression, just like in the Sudan there. What were they armed with? Pointed mango fruit?
No, the oars were, they weren't just armed farmers. These were expert shots. And because of the discovery of the gold, they were able to buy the best weaponry. So they were actually armed with the German 7mm Mauser, the smokeless version.
Smokeless?
Yeah, so you couldn't see where you were being sniped at, for example. And they were bloody good shots. And they were effective up to sort of 1,200 yards, where the British view was anything over 800 yards was practically luck. These were very,
you needed
very
volley.
Good.
You needed volley fire almost. If
yeah,
it was overrated.
And they're very good at field craft. They're masters of concealment, and they had not only better rifles, but they had better artillery as well.
Well, that's surprising. Yeah, they had Krupp, didn't they? Krupp
they
guns.
Did.
And the other thing, they were highly mobile, and this is crucial to what happens in the campaign. They are mostly mounted, and they're highly mobile, much more mobile than anybody that we'd faced before. They have an annual call-up, they have a weapons test, and they keep their white rifles at home. This is going to be a problem, isn't it?
It is. I mean, that is a very good description of what we would describe as a personal weapon. You know, it's their responsibility. The training is superb. They are a very competent foe.
And there we are. We're outnumbered by 39,000. And what's our plan? Is it a good plan, Gary?
Well, I think it's a very simple plan. The first intention was to defend the Cape Colony because it was well known that...
And Natal.
Yeah, and Natal. It was well known that the superior Boer forces would look to take those towns. And then the idea was to invade what was known as the Orange Free State, followed by the Transvaal. This is absolute nonsense.
No. Yeah. You're saying that British generals and politicians are capable of nonsense?
Yeah, it's pie in the sky, frankly.
Thank God we have a regime now in Britain that never, ever, ever, ever has sort of nonsensical decisions and makes mistakes. It's a blessing, isn't it? Now, when do they get out there? They set off in September, so they arrive, surprisingly, in October, 10th of October, at Cape Town. And when they get there, it's the cusp of the war. The war hasn't actually been declared at this point. I think it's declared next... Oh, it's next day, yes. They're declared next day. And who's in charge? They're initially attached to Cavalry Brigade, and that's with an infantry division that's being formed up to defend the Natal under the command of the... Oh, he's so old. The Venerable. He's always referred to as Venerable or Old or Pastor. Sir George White, General Sir George White.
Hang on. How old was he?
He was 64, Gary.
How old are you, Pete?
65.
I guess I'm calling you the Venerable Peter Hart. Well, or just old.
Venerable Bede, I am.
Venerable something.
The war starts next day, 11th of October, 1899. And they set sail on the Norman again via Port Elizabeth. I don't know why I'm doing this. They go up to Durban, and they arrive on the 19th of October. They go ashore, and they get on a choo-choo-choo-choo-choo-choo train to Ladysmith. Now, is this a safe journey?
No, because you've got the Boers are highly mobile, Pete. We've already said that. And also, you know, you're on a fixed line. They couldn't go very far from the rail lines because, don't forget, this is the height of the summer in South Africa. This is 100 degrees in some areas. And the Boers know about the train lines.
So they might have cut the line, but it's quite interesting that Haig is fairly sanguine about the whole thing. He doesn't worry too much, does he? What does he say?
He says, "I slept soundly through all."
It's an experienced old campaigner now. He's not worried, is he? Anyway, they get there on 0540. That's in the morning on the 20th of October. And they were immediately ordered to go on a recce in strength with the 5th Lancers and a mounted infantry force. And they were going to the railway station at Elandslaag, where the Boers had been ordered, where the Boers had cut the line. This is what you're talking about. The Boers know the importance of the railways. So they do a recce, and then Haig prepares plans for an attack next morning, 4 o'clock. So he doesn't have much time, does he, to prepare the plans. And next day, French and Haig, and it's like some sort of...
French and Saunders.
And 5 squadrons of the Imperial Light Horse and the Natal Field Battery, they head off for the Elandslaag station, covered by some of the Natal Light Horse. And they find that the Boers are there in strength, about 1,000 men, 2 or 3 long-range guns. And so they call for reinforcements, a couple of infantry battalions are sent, more guns, so a squadron of the 5th Lancers, 2 squadrons of mounted rifles. And there's quite a battle, isn't it? Tell me about the battle.
First of all, I'd say that it's quite interesting. The infantry are commanded by our old friend Sir Ian Hamilton.
Ooh,
so we're starting to see some of the characters that we know and love from the Great War are starting to appear through these conflicts. So I've got a quote from Haig here, and he says, "The batteries crossed the railway and opened fire on the enemy's guns, which were already in position and knew the range. The Imperial Light Horse, with 1 squadron of the 5th Lancers, covered the right flank of the infantry attack. and, acting dismounted, pushed forward in line with the Gordon Highlanders. Fine body of men. After bombarding the position for half an hour, the infantry pushed forward, one battalion against the front and two along the ridge against the enemy's left flank. All available cavalry was concentrated upon the left and occupied Ellenslagt station at 4:45 p.m. and from there threatened the enemy's right and rear. As the enemy began to leave the position, a squadron of lancers and one of dragoons charged through the fugitives, killing many and capturing 40 prisoners. The position was captured about 6 p.m. night, put an end to the pursuit.
Now, he writes to his sister, doesn't he, Henrietta, and this is a theme of it. Henrietta's a sort of replacement mother in some weird way.
He's in constant communication with her throughout, well, frankly, throughout his career.
And he writes,
"The Boers fought till the end with extraordinary courage. This is accounted for by the fact that the command was composed of high-class Boers who had more or less organised the present revolt and so must sink or swim by the result of the campaign. The Imperial Light Horse fought well. After the battle, I had a busy night examining prisoners and preparing for the return of troops and wounded to Ladysmith. We had prisoners of all kinds, Boers, Germans, Hollanders, American Irish, British, naturalised Boers, etc., etc. All the leaders were either shot down or taken prisoner. None escaped. The Boers say they never thought the British could have taken their position. They abandoned their tents, wagons, everything in fact, and took to flight. Some 1815 brandy was found in one of the wagons.
Ow!
They are wild at the way the fugitives were killed with the lance. They say it is butchery, not war. But as they use express rifle bullets, I don't quite see where the difference comes in."
This is a constant refrain. Other sides always accuse people of dum-dum bullets, express rifle bullets. There's always this idea. Part of it's because of damage rifle bullets do, and part of it's because I'm not sure dum-dum bullets and things have been properly outlawed at that time. But it's a constant refrain. In the First World War at Gallipoli, they're going on and on about the Turks using dum-dum bullets, and the Turks go on, it's the same. It's a constant theme. Now, so this is quite a success, and then White orders them to fall back on Ladysmith. There are reasons for that, which we won't go into. He's not being stupid. But it's a really important part, because what's going on at Mafeking and Kimberley? How are they doing there?
Well, they're coming under siege because, Ellenslagt was the first British victory. The British hadn't been doing particularly well. So there'd been a number of defeats, and Mafeking Kimberley were under siege, and the Natal troops were concentrating at Ladysmith. They're also under threat of being encircled. Not good news.
It isn't good news, is it? And now the cavalry attack. Now, notice, one thing I would say is you notice that he talks about dismounted cavalry action. To Haig, and this is a constant theme of this, cavalry are the all-round soldiers. They can gallop up to somewhere. They can either charge with the arme blanche, a sword or lance, or they can fight on foot. They are the all-round soldier, the perfect soldier to Haig. Anyway, there's several small actions, and Haig thinks that the cavalry are the key weapon in this campaign, and this is illustrated when he hears that an infantry column had been obliged to surrender on the 30th of October. What does he say, Gary? It's quite interesting, isn't it?
"The Gloucester Regiment and Royal Irish Fusiliers had been surrounded yesterday about 2 p.m. and forced to surrender. Their ammunition is stated to have run out owing to the ammunition mules having been stampeded by Boers throwing stones down the mountainside into the gorge through which the detachment was marching. It should be noticed that this detachment moved without any cavalry at all. As well let a blind man out without a dog as infantry without some horsemen to attend and reconnoitre for it."
That is quite an interesting thing. And of course, he's right. It's just what force provides the reconnaissance. And as the 20th century moves on, it will become aircraft. It will become light tanks or armoured cars. But the principle is the same. You don't have infantry marching in through hostile
ground. But they're blind.
With that blind.
Yeah.
And people are misunderstanding what Haig's saying often. Now, orders come back from General Redvers Buller that the dynamic duo, Batman and Robin, I presume. Oh, no.
French and Saunders.
French and Saunders, or French and Haig. Which one of those? You can't get everything right in podcasts, can we? They're needed back at Cape Town because French is going to take command of the cavalry division that's being formed, coming out from the UK. They set off at 1300 hours on 3rd of November. And it's quite a journey, isn't it? It really is. Now, by this time, is that railway, is it cut or not, Gary? Let's hear what Haig has to say.
The train consisted of an engine, two trucks and the guard's van, at the end of which there was a first-class compartment. The general, self and two ADCs travelled in first-class compartment, seven servants and the guard in the guard's van, nine horses in one of the trucks and our baggage in the other. No passengers went with this train. The train, which started at 10 a.m, had been fired upon, and the railway authorities doubted our getting through. About half an hour after leaving, the train came under a heavy fire from both sides of the railway. We heard shells bursting and bullets hit the carriages. We all lay down on the seats and floor. Not a very dignified position for the cavalry division staff to assume, but discretion is sometimes the better part of valour. Pieter's station was reached about 1:30. The train halted. A British post was found here. As we went again, and about 3 miles beyond, the train was again fired upon. At about 2 p.m, Colenso station was reached. An examination of our train showed that the iron truck containing some of our baggage had been pierced by a 2 or 2.5 inch shell. Had the shell hit the engine or a wheel, we should have been on our way to Pretoria instead of to Durban. Or indeed, if the Boers had torn up a rail, the engine driver would not have seen it, because the moment the Boers began shooting, he laid down amongst the coal.
And who blames him, Gary?
No one.
Well, it's not going to go off the rails, is it? Unless they tore up a rail. some of Haig's luggage is damaged in it by a shell. And it really is a close shave. It is a very close shave. And there's an armoured train follows him about a mile behind. And that was the last train to get through before they actually cut the line and Ladysmith is besieged. They leave behind General Sir George White. And he may have been venerable or old or past it or whatever else you think people of that age are. I don't know. You young thrusters like you, Gary, or Haig, who is considerably younger than you. There's still fire in his belly, I think, and there's fire in mine, Gary. And his position in Ladysmith looks untenable, and General Sir Redvers Buller orders him to destroy their guns and surrender on the best terms he can. And White responds with the brilliant, Ladysmith for the Queen. But he can't have been that particular accent because he would have surrendered, definitely. And he does hold out. He holds out for another 4 months before the town's relieved in February 1900. I like Sir George White. He's my kind of guy. Old and bastard, but capable of great determination. Anyway, Haig goes to Cape Town. He's thinking about what he's seen about the campaign, and he's come to some conclusions. Let's just run through these conclusions. So what's his first conclusion, Gary?
Well, he thinks that artillery fire is chiefly having a moral effect, and the effect of the shrapnel fire itself was pretty disappointing, frankly. And it had been up to that point. And as you rightly have pointed out on a number of occasions through our podcast, the British introduced the 18-pounder due to the inadequacies of their artillery, which uncovered in this war.
That's right. So, it isn't the deadly weapon it was in the First World War, the Great War.
No, they made changes as a result of what they found.
Now, another one is the one that it's always hung round his neck. He's convinced the cavalry have a vital role. And they need that mobility to counter the mobility of the Boer horsemen. Now,
well, he's right in this case, isn't he? You cannot have a mobile enemy and not be mobile yourself. He's absolutely right.
He likes the new cavalry carbine, and he rates the potential for the firepower that dismounted cavalry can generate, having been moved on their horses quickly. I think he's right. But then another thing is often hung around his neck as a thing. He's very against mounted infantrymen, isn't he?
He's very disparaging of them. He considers them to be a waste of scarce quality horses.
He thinks, and fodder. I think the words waste of space is what you were going to say.
He's very critical of their horsemanship. He considers them to be poor horsemen. He means that they're unable to keep their horses healthy. He's incapable of carrying out a proper recce if you've got a poor horse.
So what does he want?
Well, he wants properly trained cavalry. Not necessarily regular cavalry, but he thinks... You know, the Imperial Light Horse, for example, he admired them greatly. He just wants the highest standard of training, and ultimately a cavalryman should be a good horseman, capable of using a sword or lance, as mentioned, as the arme blanche in a charge, carrying out a recce, or acting dismounted as a fully competent infantryman.
So what he's asking for is the perfect soldier.
Yeah.
And
with a perfect animal as well. I mean, he sees the two going hand in hand.
Now, French is put in charge of the cavalry. Now, they're to defend the Cape Colony from the Boer attack. They're from the Colesberg. They're coming from Colesberg. And Buller orders French to mount an active defence and to tie down the enemy. Now, Haig, as his chief of staff, he does most of the detail work, doesn't he? What's Haig doing as chief of staff?
I'm really very busy. So many things to arrange. We have the line of communications from Port Elizabeth to control, as well as this place and the enemy, some 5,000, to retain at Colesberg. The civilians get excited, and we are flooded with telegrams from magistrates and those who think the seaside is the only safe place.
You've got a caravan at the seaside.
Yeah, and under lockdown, I hope it's very safe. Others again get fits and get ill in diverse ways, of which we must be duly informed. So we have information of all sorts to deal with and so many questions to ask. We administer martial law, of course, rough and ready. Then again, on the one hand, we have Gataka defeated at Stormberg on Sunday morning, and tonight we hear that Methuen has been checked on the Modder River. While in our front are some 4,000 to 5,000 Boers, about 13 miles this side of Colesberg. Our task is to bluff them with the few cavalry we have. So far, we've been successful in hemming them in. If we only had sufficient cavalry with fit horses, we could do anything we liked with the Boers.
Now, they were doing well, but this is in sharp contrast to what's going on, because this is during the Black Week, isn't it? Roughly speaking, the 9th to the 15th of 16th of September, of December, 1899. So what's happened? So what goes wrong in that week? What's the first disaster?
Well, as he mentioned, on the 9th, 10th of December, General Gataker's night attack into strong Boer defences at the Battle of Stormberg ended in failure.
Well, it's the first. Then, sort of the next day, 11th of December, Lieutenant General Lord Methuen. I've no idea. I mean, this is interesting that we're not familiar with these names. It shows how unfamiliar we are that we can't pronounce half the names. He was defeated at the Battle of Magersfontein, and that means they failed to relieve the siege of Kimberley. And then there's another. That's not enough, is it? There's an even worse battle coming up on the 15th of December. What's that battle, Gary?
Yeah, on the 15th of December, the force under General Sir Redvers Buller himself are defeated at the Battle of Colenso.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So all of these disasters, aren't they? Heavy casualties, very slim Bolottis. This isn't like, shooting down the dervishes, as they called them, the warriors of the Mahdi or the Khalifa in the Sudan. This is almost the reverse, isn't it? In this case, we're taking the casualties. We're the ones being shot down. I want to remove the word "we" because I don't think I'm a supporter of the British in this war.
No, and
I think we're the baddies.
And there's a contrast, isn't there? Because both French and, by implication, Haig are doing well at this time.
They are. How are they doing it? They're trying to bluff the Boers. They're raiding. They're marching. They're counter-marching. They're here, where, and nowhere, baby, aren't they? To quote a Fantastico. They're difficult to pin down. Nobody knows where they are. The Boers think they're opposed by a much stronger force than they actually were. Haig and French work hand in glove. And one of the sources says every day they carry out at 4:20 in the morning a joint recce. We're going out to see what's happening, get right on top of issues, and really a brilliant, almost a guerrilla campaign. Black Week results in a change in command. Buller is removed from command as high command, and Lord Roberts comes in.
Although Buller remains in theatre, doesn't he?
He's moved sideways. They do that at Transport for London, I believe. If you're really bad, you get moved sideways. It certainly did that at the War Museum. If you were completely useless, you were promoted and moved sideways into a job that wasn't so noticeable what you were doing. Because the higher you go in any organisation, the more bloody useless.
You haven't gone off at a tangent at all here, have you?
No. Well, I think these were valid similes, Gary.
Okay. So Lord Roberts arrives, and who's he got with him, Pete?
Would that be Kitchener of Khartoum?
He has. He's his chief of staff.
Yeah, it seems ridiculous knowing what a useless idiot Rob. Well, sorry, I shouldn't say that. It seems weird to have him as chief of staff and not in command. But there you go. So Kitchener, fresh from his triumph as Sirdar, commander-in-chief in the Egyptian Sudan theatre, comes in as chief of staff to Roberts to provide some sort of whatever. How do the British react to reverses then and always? There'd been reverses, so what do they do? They send in what?
Reinforcements.
Yes.
Get reinforcements and actually go on the offensive.
And that's what happens. They send in, instead of trying to win with 15,000 troops outnumbered, they send in masses of reinforcements, masses and masses. And this is, for the rest of this podcast, you can assume that the British are steadily reinforcing. More and more troops are being sent out. Thousands, and later on it gets up to hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, by the end of the war, I believe it's close on 500,000 soldiers have actually passed through South Africa.
So that's going on throughout that. They're being sent to South Africa. Now, in late January 1900, French, Sir John French, no, John French, yes,
Major
first of the war.
General.
No, Major General. Yes, yeah, stop confusing me. Major General French is appointed to command the cavalry division, and he asks for Haig to be his chief of staff, as he would. Now, this is the point about the loan. This is why it looks bad. It looks bad, doesn't it, Gary? But nevertheless, there's a reason for it, because this is what French says when he telegraphs Lord Roberts. This is in January. What does he say? Oh, I say it. French. Right. Here I go. I'm going to be John French now. Major Haig has performed duty of chief staff officer to a division since landing in Natal. He has acted in this capacity under my command in three general engagements and many, many smaller fights. I have several times mentioned him in my dispatches. His services have been invaluable. So how does what happens? Of course.
Well, firstly, I'd say, you know, given the circumstances, as you rightly say, around the loan, you know, he's mentioned him in dispatches a number of times. Those who wanted to be detracting of Haig and French could point to that as the reason that he's being mentioned in dispatches.
I don't think it is, though.
I don't think it is. I think he's performing well.
It does, but it's still wrong. And let's be fair, it's not only French who thinks Haig's doing well. It's a perception across high command at the time. Now, however, shibboleth of seniority, Haig is still a major. It's a colonel's command, and they send out Colonel Earl Errol. Now, I thought perhaps Earl was his first name.
No, there is a suggestion that Lord Roberts tended to favour those with titles in his immediate staff. And in fact, there's a suggestion that the DSOs that were awarded to his staff were for Duke's sons only.
That's the wit of the age. Oh, if only someone to write a book about military humour. And Haig must have been a bit disappointed, but he stays deputy assistant as adjutant general. He's still DAG.
And in February 1900, he writes to Henrietta and he says that his friends seem to be more concerned about it than he is. And that's probably true. He knew that given time, he would reap the rewards of his good work.
So now what happens now? The biggest thing, we can't go through the Boer War bit by bit, but there is one big thing coming up. The cavalry division are launched into the blue to accomplish the relief of Kimberley. They sweep round the Boer positions to launch a surprise attack. They set off on the 12th of February and they moved as fast as humanly possible. Now, this later becomes controversial because this manoeuvre actually destroys the effectiveness of the cavalry division by breaking so many of their horses and knackering the whole bloody division. However, it wasn't ordered by French or Haig. It was ordered by Roberts. So it's outside the scope of this, really. The logistical problems are within our scope because Haig has to cope with them. But then the final attack is launched on the 15th of February. And this is, now you've remembered the name of the place because I've forgotten it.
Well, it's Clip Drift, I think. I'm not really sure if it's...
It is.
It's K-L-I-P. It's a significant action, and in fact, Robert suggests that the date, the 15th of February, will be recalled for years to come, and I think he's right because we've recalled it.
Only because we looked it up. It was real boys' own stuff, though, wasn't it? The attack.
And Haig says there was an open plain towards Abbas Dam between the two parties of the enemy. The ground rose from the river, so we could not see whether there were wire fences or not. But there seemed to be only a few Boers at the end of the rise. There seemed only one thing to be done if we were to get to Kimberley before the Boers barred our path, namely, charge through the gap between the two positions. Half our guns were ordered to keep down the fire from the kopjes in our front, which would
That's
be on...
That's hills, isn't it? Like the kop.
Which would be... Thanks for getting that in, which would be on the right flank of the charging cavalry, and half engaged the enemy's guns. The 9th and 16th Lancers were then ordered to charge, followed by Broadwood's brigade in support. Our Lancers caught several Boers and rode down many others in the open plain, and really suffered little from the very hot rifle fire, about 20 casualties, I fancy, and we passed within 1,000 yards of the Boer position. We got to Kimberley about 6 p.m, The garrison made not the slightest attempt to assist us. The people of Kimberley looked fat and well. It was the relieving force which needed food.
And this is all part of this thing, this attack. There's two points I want to make, one of which has just occurred to me when you're talking. This is very like one of Rommel's armoured sweeps around the right of the British Army in North Africa. It is if you think of cavalry as being an armoured division, you sort of get the feel of what's going on here. A sudden thrust out into the blue and then smashing into people, catching them by surprise. That's the first point I want to make. The second is that Kimberley wasn't in particularly dire need of being relieved, and that I'm going to use the words utter bastard Cecil Rhodes, because he's one of the people most responsible for this totally unnecessary war. He treated the senior staff to a champagne reception. with lovely food and everything, and it's just and it does really damage the it damages the cavalry. They are absolutely buggered, to use the technical term. Their horses are totally exhausted, and they do not recover for quite a while. 29th of February, Ladysmith formally relieved, and I think the mood music's changed now, hasn't it? It's not the Boers threatening us.
No, the British are now in the advantage.
Now, somebody else is on the up as well. Who's that?
Well, Haig's personal career is on the rise. On the 21st of February, he's been promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. And surprise, surprise, he's appointed to replace Lord Errol as French's Assistant Adjutant General. So presumably Lord Errol didn't do too good a job.
Yeah, it's they moved him sideways. Ridiculous. The next phase of the is directed by Roberts, and he this is the advance on the Orange Free State capital of Bloemfontein. Thank you. They were blocked by a strong Boer force at Poplar Grove, and so again, 7th of March.
Poplar Grove.
I said Poplar Grove, you
yes,
bastard.
Yes, you did.
You're not going to... just disrupting me. You know I'm not too knowledgeable about this. And we're not going to do this. He sends out the cavalry division again, plus two mounted infantry brigades, and another flank march. And this time, to cut off the Boers' retreat to Bloemfontein. And it doesn't work, does it? The Boers manage to escape and disengage. Now, several... And that includes most of the Boer high command. Not when Boer, Haig talked about the high command being with the Elandslacht, he was talking bollocks. They weren't there.
And who are we talking about? We're talking about Bertha de Witt.
It's both presidents of both republics. Yeah, they're both here. And they escape. He doesn't capture President Kruger. They don't capture everybody. And Roberts is furious with French. Indeed, the two start to fall out. He blames him. Haig excuses the cavalry. He points out they're just completely and utterly knackered. Their horses are knackered. They've been in action since the 11th of February. And he also, as was his wont, casts aspersions at the mounted infantry brigade. He just says they're useless and waste of horse flesh. However, Bloemfontein is still occupied on 13th of March, and then Johannesburg on the 31st of May, Pretoria 5th of June. Oh, it's all over. Iran! That must be the end of the podcast. Well, it's quite short today, isn't it?
Yeah.
44 minutes. Oh. Well, what happens next then? I suppose it's tea and buns. Tea and crumpets.
The war changes from battles to a guerrilla-based resistance, which are carried out by skillful, hardy men determined not to accept defeat and, in fact, referred to as the Bitter Enders.
You're occasionally referred to as a Bitter Ender.
I'm saying nothing. Whatever I say now would be wrong.
Now, Haig, they're facing this new thing, and he's a bit taken aback, isn't he? He's wondering how 70,000 British troops, which is how many were in theatre at that time, are being defied. And they reckon there's only about 2,000 Boers under de Wet. And he's also becoming critical of Lord Roberts. And you've discerned a theme here. You're going to read the quote, but you've discerned a theme about Haig by now, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, he's often critical of his senior officers, and particularly in his letters to Henrietta. And in fact, in one letter, points out that the then Prince of Wales had commented on how he should be more careful about some of the comments that he's making. But it's something he does throughout his career. And you could perhaps understand it, particularly as, you know, he was asked to comment by Evelyn Wood when he was in the Sudan. So he just kept that going. And
so what does he say?
Well, he's talking about Lord Roberts, and he says, "The Field Marshal was in a bad temper yesterday and opened upon French because so many men were missing. But what can you expect to happen if horses stop from exhaustion and one covers 60 or more miles in 2 days? Kitchener also has a baddish time with Roberts' temper. The Landrofs of Kroonstad came out to surrender the town to French, but we packed him off into the town again to wait for the Field Marshal. The latter, meantime, had heliographed that no patrols were to enter the town. We came on here with the cavalry, and Roberts marched in at the head of the infantry. I'm afraid he's a silly old man and scarcely fit to be CNC of this show.
Now, that's quite sharp on Roberts, but there's a lot. There's quite a lot that people say that he made a fixation of taking the capitals, and he didn't try and catch the Boer troops. And this is an enduring theme that people are on about. Now, are the cavalry still busy? Do they still have a role in this new guerrilla warfare? I suspect the answer to this is going to be yes, once they've recovered.
Yeah, and Haig says, the infantry are quite jealous of the successes of the cavalry. The poor creatures merely carry their guns without loosing off. In fact, they simply wear out their boots to no purpose. All the same, but for the cavalry, many of them would now be below ground.
So this is a restatement of this theme. It's certainly not over, is it? And so the cavalry division's divided up into lots of columns, and they've got to protect supply lines, they've got to provide mobile columns, they've got to pursue and exterminate these guerrilla bands. That's what's going on. And during this time, Haig is French's chief of staff. And his orderly mind is coping with a lot of problems, a lot. This is where everybody's saying, why hasn't Haig got an independent command? But that's not what's happening, is it? That both Haig and French, they both think he should carry on in the job he's got.
Yeah, his old mentor, Evelyn Wood, was really anxious that Haig be given command of a regiment. But both Haig and French believed that the requirements of the service were best served by him remaining in post and assisting French.
Absolutely. Now, Lord Roberts, who doesn't come out of this utterly well, he goes home in December 1900.
That's all over.
It's all over bar the shouting. Well, there, another 2 years shouting. And he leaves Kitchener as commander-in-chief, which... now, in previously, Haig's been slightly critical of, I think you'd call it, minor tactics of Kitchener. He thinks that... And he had criticised, and he also criticised, as a staff officer, which Haig was, the over-centralisation of command functions. That is the way that Kitchener always operates. But he does recognise his talents, doesn't he? You've got a quote here.
Yeah, he says, Kitchener occasionally gets alarmed without real cause and hurries troops to this or that point without sufficiently considering what the effect must be. So one is forced to conclude that the Sirdar is not that large-minded man capable of taking a broad view of the whole situation, which the papers would have us believe he is. At the same time, there is no doubt that he has great energy and power of organising. So let us hope that the present state of this country will soon improve.
Now, Kitchener brings a change of policy, doesn't it? And what he does is controversial in the extreme and in some senses indefensible. He divides up the veldt. He uses hundreds of miles of barbed wire, defended blockhouses. And that's just to try and restrict the Boers' freedom of movement, which is, of course, their main asset. He also introduces, indefensible, a scorched earth policy. They burnt the farms, the crops, they killed the animals or gathered them in to deny them to the Boer bands. And he gathers Boer civilians into concentration camps. Now, you feel strongly about this, don't you, Gary? Well, we both feel strongly about
this. Yeah, I mean, they destroyed about 30,000 Boer homesteads. And originally, these camps, which were given the really unfortunate name of concentration camps, were meant to be purely there to house the dispossessed people. But of 154,000 Boer and African women and children that were incarcerated in these camps, about 32,000 died. Now, that's about 21%, so one in five. Now, a disproportionate amount of those deaths were from childhood diseases, so were children. You know, it was incompetence rather than neglect or overt malevolence.
I think it was neglect. I think it's incompetence and neglect, mate.
Well, I just think they hadn't thought about it at all.
What are these diseases? So
Well, it's primarily typhoid and measles. It ran riot. You know, the camps were crowded. There's no excuse, Pete. You know, I'm struggling here because there is absolutely no excuse at all.
Well, now, what about Haig? Is Haig, as you know, Haig is one of my probably favourite generals. I presume Haig condemned this behaviour. I presume Haig is a reasonable, intelligent man, was appalled by this.
No, he's very much in favour of them. I've got a quote here. Haig says, "Many poor creatures brought in their guns and swore an oath not to fight us again. Then we withdraw our troops and the Transvaalers burn all the farms. Such conduct merely brings us into contempt, although Roberts no doubt expected to gain popularity with the British public by being generous and merciful to the conquered. It seems high time we treated these people with greater severity. Up to the present, we have made the war too pleasant for the Free Staters, and so they allow it to continue. If we were only to loot and burn a few farms, the inhabitants would wish to get us out of the country soon and at once sue for peace."
Now, this is the policies of the time. Colonial times were rough, very rough. But we don't think it excuses... I don't think it excuses Kitchener. It doesn't excuse Haig as one of the... I mean, he's the chief of staff. He's one of the main practitioners. And I don't think it excuses the British at all. I think this is terrible behaviour. And a stain on Haig's career. And Kitchener and the British Empire. We are not coming out of this well, are we?
No, and in some respects you can excuse the treatment of the fighting Boers themselves, because the British saw them as treasonable, frankly. So they were acting in a treasonable way in their view. But you cannot excuse what happened to the civilian population. And, you know, it's a large proportion of the overall population. 32,000 dead.
It's terrible. Now, in January 1901, Haig at last gets his independent command. It's about a brigade strength and divided up into three columns. It rises to about six. And they're mobile columns, mainly of cavalry, various for forms and mounted infantry. And they're operating in the northwest of Cape Colony. How does Haig feel about that?
Well, he's absolutely delighted. And he says, "This is quite a big business to have in hand. And I came from Johannesburg without any staff at all, but have been most fortunate in picking up fellows to assist. If you will look at the map, you will see the great area over which troops under my control are operating. The question of feeding and keeping in communication with the several parts of the column is at times difficult, while at the same time I have had to assist in the administration of the districts through which I passed. All the magistrates nearly are disloyal, and three quarters of the population. Indeed, I may say all farmers are Dutch. However, I enjoy myself very well. This is a nice change to have a show of one's own. At last, I've got quite a nice command, much more interesting than a cavalry brigade, because I can get no orders from anyone, but merely move as I think best in pursuit of the enemy."
So he's weaving backwards and forwards across the veldt, the different columns, a real threat to any guerrilla forces in the area. Now, in July 1901, he's also promoted. He's double-hatted, isn't he? Yeah. What happens next?
Yeah, he gets appointed to command of the 17th Lancers.
They're quite a fashionable regiment, aren't
they? Yeah, they are. And Haig says, "I took over command of the 17th Lancers last Thursday, as I thought it best to identify myself with the regiment as soon as possible, having been appointed their commanding officer. I have them here with me, and find I can easily look after the regiment in addition to directing the other columns. I know the country so well now that it does not bother me much to make up my mind where to send the latter to hunt the enemy. Besides, I am giving the squadron commanders a chance of having a little show occasionally on their own account. There is nothing so good as responsibility for making good officers."
He'd enjoyed responsibility himself, hadn't he? And now he was... this is good. He's giving responsibility to other people in the same way as he'd been lucky enough to have it in the Sudan, for instance. Now, we can't look at... There's lots of time. We're just going to look at some themes now. Let's go through the themes. Let's pick up... Well, my first theme that I want to look at, and I think you've got supporting quotes for these, so we'll try... My first theme is, it's really, really, really difficult to pin down the Boer guerrilla forces, isn't it? It is frustrating for them.
Yeah, Haig says, by August 1st, I had a line of stops from a point west of Mariusburg, about 200 miles long. Kritzinger and some other commanders tried to break through my line of stops, but they were checked in the passes and retired northwards. I followed them up at once and fairly hunted them back and fore, but always getting them northwards. Then, on the 9th of August, I really had Kritzinger and his men surrounded, but somehow he managed to slip through. But I had Kravis' column handy, and making him leave his guns, we raced Kritzinger for about 30 miles as hard as we could go up to the Tibus Railway. I told old Krabby to kill every horse if necessary, but he must gallop. The Boers took up a position about 14 miles north of Mariusburg, but we soon had them out of it and continued the chase until quite dark.
And this is what's happening all the time, is it? There's the dashing here, there, and every harassing, pursuing the Boer guerrilla forces. Now, the other thing is that there are continual ambushes and reverses. That's the thing about guerrilla warfare, isn't it, Gary? You get these sudden attacks just because they can pick their point at which they attack you. And so they're going to catch you unawares at times. And this happens. You've got a quote here now from Haig.
Yeah, not forgetting, of course, that there are losses all the time during these actions. And Haig says, our men held the position to the last.
This is a bunch of his own regiment and the mounted infantry that were caught. Yeah, sorry, Gary. Yeah.
Our men held the position to the last and not a man surrendered. Out of 130 men, 29 were killed and 41 wounded. The other men were still fighting when the next squadron came up to their support and the enemy made off. All the officers were either killed or wounded. Such nice fellows, too. It made one feel very miserable to see what had taken place. The wounds were terrible. The brutes used explosive bullets. I at once galloped to the scene of action, but was too late to come up with the enemy.
And this is, he was clearly shocked. And Haig was always quite upset by casualties, but he tried to control that throughout his later career, and he had good reason to have to. Now, the other theme, I'm sorry, is that Haig develops a really, really harsh attitude to the Boers, and he considers them, it's in quotes, brutes and ruffians. And the rule was that to him, all Boers caught wearing British khaki uniforms were to be shot out of hand. And that mirrors French and Kitchener's orders. Another double act there, French and Kitchener. To Haig, they're just brutes. They're traitors, aren't they? They're traitors to the crown, as far as he's concerned. But, you know, one man's resistance hero is another man's terrorist monster. Again, we have aspects of that in our lives today. Give us an example of what he says that shows this. Well, brutality, his brutality as well.
My columns all the time close on the enemy's tail. I don't think the latter's horses can go much longer. He's dropped a good many and we have picked up some prisoners. Those taken in khaki, we shot at once. One was taken actually riding with our scouts and wearing the uniform of Nesbitt's horse. The fellow's movements seemed suspicious and he was arrested for identification. His uniform was complete, all except the badge NH, which he pretended he had only just lost. Finally, he confessed that he was a Boer and was promptly shot.
Now, that's harsh. On the other hand, it's been known before that these things happen, but it's part of a very nasty war. The other thing is Haig is very well aware of the nature of the problems of anti-insurgency warfare. But it's just the sheer complexity. And he's got, here's another quote of how he struggles to deal with just keeping all these columns, all the blockhouses, everything in the air, afloat, if you like, not that they're at sea.
I had the line of blockhouses, which is being erected in that area, also under me. I have four columns, really more than I can feed. It will take 300 wagons to feed two columns. This will show you the difficulties of carrying on war in this country where there are no railways. Still, the numbers of the enemy are well over 1,400, and in a rugged country of this sort, with bad roads and no supplies and little water, all is in favour of the defender, who can live scattered about on the farms of his friends and merely concentrate when a good chance offers at attacking some carelessly guarded convoy.
This is the point again. They pick their time. They pick their moment to attack when you're most vulnerable. Now, he's not the only one who thinks that. One of his staff college contemporaries was there. In fact, nearly everybody from the First World War is there. One, Hunter Weston was at Clip Drift. But Lieutenant Colonel Edmund Allenby. Now, he's bad-tempered as well. And this. Listen to how similar this quote is. I'll just read this. He goes, "I should rather like some of those fashionable warriors who went home at the end of the war to come out and see what war looks like now that it is at an end. It might give them a few new ideas. As far as my experience goes, the war was the easiest part of the campaign. We've had more fighting since the war ended, more trekking and much more discomfort. I've lost 32 horses in 9 days, only 2 of which were lost in action. The rest have died from exhaustion and short food. There is no help for it, exhausted as we are. We must patrol a lot to keep Brother Boer at a distance, as well as collect grub. I must say, all the men of my column are splendid, keen as mustard, and one never hears a grumble." Would you have grumbled being in one of those columns?
I was just about to say, he must have been deaf.
Oh dear, yeah. And that's Allenby. It's the same experience. It's hard. Yes, it is hard for them, but it's a brutal response, and we keep underlining that. Now, eventually, peace negotiations begin. Is Haig a tolerant?
No, his instinct is that of a hardliner, and he says, "I hope there is no question of giving terms to these rebels. It would be much better to go on fighting for 10 years than give way in anything to them."
And that's not how he was at the end of the Great War. So perhaps he'd learned by then. So what happens in May 1902? Well, the war comes to an end, and Haig's distinctly ambivalent about the peace terms, isn't he? Because he thinks they're too reasonable, that the loyal men who stayed true to the crown, they're almost ignored. But he's also happy to accept peace if there's a period of martial law. And it just all comes to an end. It's strange, isn't it? He's still got a lot of staff work to complete at the end of the war, but do you think he'd had a good war?
Well, I think it's fair to say both he and French had had a really good war. I mean, French in the public perception was a hero of the war and had featured largely in newspapers, as did Haig. He'd had a good war. He was effectively a brigade commander on active service.
So not just a chief of staff, he'd been effectively, yeah, it's
and as you say, it was a very smart cavalry regiment, 17th.
He was given command of that. He's now a lieutenant colonel. So when he sails back with the 17th Lancers, he goes back. He gets back to England in late mid October 1902. Do you think his career's taken flight? Because he was a bit stalled, but he was. How do you think it's gone?
No, I mean, he's quite popular. He's offered command of the Aldershot Cavalry Brigade, and Kitchener actually offers him the position of Inspector General of the Indian Cavalry.
Now, they're both fantastic opportunities, aren't they? They really are.
He's clearly destined for high rank, isn't he, at this stage?
Is he the coming man?
Well, that's a good phrase, yes.
We'll talk about which one he picks, and we'll talk about the rest of his career in another session. But back to the war. So he's had a good time. Has he learnt? What has he learnt, do you think, from because he'd learnt a lot in the Sudan. What's he learnt in the Boer War?
Well, apart from the importance of cavalry, which we've featured throughout, he's learnt that there's a vital need for staff officers to plan the operations and organise the logistics, without which the army would soon starve and run out of ammunition. And that stays with him throughout his career from this point on.
He does show an understanding of the importance of logistics in the Great War, yes. Now, we want to finish with some remarks about, about the Boer War. So, was it worth it? I mean, how many troops did they deploy?
Well,
you
ultimately...
said about half a million.
It's in excess of 400,000 troops are ultimately deployed. There's around 10,000 African soldiers also in South Africa. The cost was... this is a staggering number for the time, some £200 million and 22,000 lives. And that's just the British, of course. The Boers lost around 25,000 and the Africans around 12,000.
And then there's all the civilians, I presume.
Yeah. Now, let's not forget that within 10 years, the Union of South Africa, which is the predecessor historically of the modern day Republic of South Africa, came into being on the 31st of May 1910, the first Prime Minister of which was Louis Botha.
Wasn't he a brute?
He was a brute.
According to Hague.
And a rebel. And
a traitor.
A traitor. In fact, it was 8 years. 8 years later, he's the Prime Minister of the country.
So what is this war achieved? What's it for?
Well, I think we go back to our opening remarks, really. It's about imperialism and British influence and having access to the gold. I mean, the gold fields recover relatively quickly. Within 4 years, they're at pre-war levels, and they're second in the world only to American gold mines at that point.
So there's a great comedy sketch once. Are we the baddies?
Yes, we're the baddies.
we're not saying that the Boers are necessarily that lovely.
No, and
but in this war, we are the baddies.
Yeah, and you have to think about why people went to South Africa in the first place. Often, you know, the Huguenots went there, the Dutch, the British. It was to get away and to have, quote, freedom. It's not really surprising they were prepared to fight for it.
So there you go. Hague's done well in a war that not our greatest or finest hour as a British Empire. We're going to continue talking about Hague. We're going to look at his career before the Great War in a podcast to come up in a month or two. And I hope you've enjoyed it. I'll go back to the beginning and say I hope you'll remember to buy my book, The Gallipoli Evacuation, which you can get on livinghistorytv.com. And if you do, you'll make Matt Glenn very happy. Thanks for joining me, Gary. You've been like a little ray of sunshine in my lockdown life.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?